Up next, Russ Baker back with us on Coast to Coast, talking about some new research that he's been working on with regards to the JFK assassination, which, of course, is all-encompassing when you look at the entire picture. So I'll be back with Russ in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. You might remember about a year and a half ago, Russ was with us as we talked about his work, Family of Secrets. It's a best-selling investigative book, Family of Secrets, and he's written for major news organizations all around this planet. He is the founder and editor-in-chief of the news site whowhatwhy.com, which specializes in digging into stories that most of the media doesn't touch, and he goes for those answers, and he gets them. Russ, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Hey, George, likewise. Great to be here.
See, you know, some people would say, come on, the Kennedy assassination anniversary, it's not here yet, but it's a huge story, isn't it?
You know, it is a huge story. I mean, on almost any level. First of all, it is the arguably, depending on your view on it, the greatest unsolved mystery in the country's history, one of the greatest unresolved mysteries in the recent history of the world, I would say. And more broadly, it is a question of what happened to this country half a century ago that may still be percolating, may still be affecting the state of our country today, the state of democracy in this country.
Every time I'm at a speaking engagement, Russ, and we talk about what was the beginning point of where we think we lost control of our country, that's what people bring up. They say it was the Kennedy assassination, which was the beginning of this muck that we've been in. And I would agree with that.
You know, great point, George. And by the way, on our website, Who, What, Why, we just ran Dwight Eisenhower's valedictory address, the so-called military-industrial complex speech. People don't realize that back when he made that speech, it got almost no attention. And it was this really stunning, stunning statement in which he basically essentially sort of signaled that he himself, a celebrated military man, had been something of a captive as president. And keep in mind, George, this is before Kennedy. This is as Kennedy has come in. That was the state of affairs. And then what you saw was a situation where John F. Kennedy, along with his brother Robert, were really a response to the situation that had developed in the country, the one that Ike had warned about. And then all of the things that they did and how they ended up really, and I think this is one of our pieces of our history that's been suppressed. You don't see it in the textbooks. You don't see it in these best-selling books by the promoted historians, this story of how so much of the establishment in this country was so corrupt in so many respects, and how the Kennedys really were almost fearlessly, and I would say basically recklessly, going after all of these key power centers, and certainly, of course, the military and the growth of war as an industry, crucial to the economy, and really sense of self-worth of this country were becoming so prominent.
No doubt. So let's talk a little bit more about JFK and what some of your new research is beginning to show.
Sure. And let me say just a kind of a shout out to what is called the JFK research community. It is sort of a tragedy and yet sort of thrilling that because of the complete abdication by the American inquiry establishment, and I'm talking about journalism, talking about outfits like Hollywood, the publishing industry, academia, all this, their failures to get to the bottom of this thing or even to have the courage to look into it honestly and thoroughly has caused this sort of, you know, cottage industry to sprout up. And so there are these hundreds, maybe thousands, of what you might call ordinary citizens who dig into these things. And so I, you might say, sort of stand on their shoulders. I think they all do tremendous, tremendous work. And so just to quickly tick off a few of the
sure
kinds of things that have been coming out, George, one example I attended a conference where there was a man by the name of Antonio Veciana, a Cuban exile of some prominence, who has come forward to say that prior to the Kennedy assassination, he was working with the Central Intelligence Agency, and he had a handler, and he eventually realized by comparing pictures that his handler was a very important man by the name of David Attlee Phillips, the man who I think figures very significantly in the whole Oswald and JFK hit story. And so he tells his story that he was one day supposed to meet with David Attlee Phillips, and he got there early, and he saw Phillips with another man, and later, after the president was shot, he recognized that man, and it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, now, with Oswald, remember when Oswald came out and said he was a patsy?
Exactly.
Everybody said, what the heck is he saying? What does he mean by that? He looked like a guy who really didn't even know where he was. And I was 13 years old when I remember that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I have spent the last, I don't know how many years, looking into all kinds of aspects of this, and perhaps later on we can get into how I came to this story. And I think it's important to say that I was not what you would call a JFK assassination buff. If you go back about 8 or 9 years ago before I wrote Family of Secrets, I didn't really know much of anything about it. I was writing a book about the Bush family. And I sort of, in the course of researching the Bush family, I kind of went through what you might call a sort of a trap door into a whole different level of American history. And there were things about the Bush family that actually related to the Kennedy assassination. And so I became so intrigued, I started digging into it. Well, my God, what a tremendous amount of research one has to do to get up to speed on these things. But one of the things that startled me was really what you're talking about, this notion of Lee Harvey Oswald as this man sort of caught in the headlights. And of course, they say that he was the proud assassinate of the president, and yet people who are proud assassins basically say, I'm a proud assassin, and he didn't. And as you point out, George, he said, I'm a patsy. I didn't do this thing, and I've been set up. And in fact, my research and the research of others increasingly shows that A, he was a patsy, and B, he was a guy in a very, very difficult position, because virtually everything now, all the things that are coming out, point to the probability that Lee Harvey Oswald was developed over the years as an intelligence asset of the United States government. And this may make people howl with disbelief, but in fact, I'm perfectly happy to go through some of the particulars. There's a tremendous amount of documentary evidence associating him from a very young age with operations of the U.S. government that explain how he came to be in the Marines, how he came to leave the Marines, how he came to so-called attempt to defect to the Soviet Union. All of this, all the documentation shows it as part of ongoing operations at very covert levels, obviously, of the U.S. government against what was agreed upon as being the biggest enemy that the United States faced, the most crucial thing, which was to battle the Soviet Union.
And we were so uptight with the Soviet Union. I mean, everybody pointed their fingers toward the Soviet Union at the time, to Castro. And again, I remember, Russ, I was 13 years old, and I'm remembering these things, the strange pictures of Oswald coming out of an embassy in Mexico that didn't look like the Oswald we saw on television. I mean, everything was just out of whack, wasn't it?
It was totally out of whack, and of course you will probably recall that we were all made to hide under desks at school to save canned goods. We were told that there was a very high probability that there was going to be a nuclear war. I mean, the U.S. was living under conditions of terror, basically. And this is the environment into which comes Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassination of Kennedy, all the things that were going on with Kennedy, where he was accused by high-ranking people in the Pentagon and in other key sectors of being an appeaser of the Soviets, an accommodationist with Khrushchev, who himself was accused by elements in his own country of being an appeaser of the United States, the sort of stand down around the Cuban Missile Crisis. All of these things were going on. It was a tremendous time. And into this walks this fellow Lee Harvey Oswald. And what we see increasingly from our research is that Oswald was, as they say, from a young age, being trained to go into these kind of paramilitary programs. He was brought into something called the Civil Air Patrol. And in my book, Family of Secrets, ostensibly about the Bush family, I have five chapters on the Kennedy assassination, and I go into the Civil Air Patrol, which is very, very interesting. The Civil Air Patrol was something where they would take non-military people or former military people, and they would be sort of ready with their airplanes to supposedly help the United States in the case of some kind of a war with Soviets or Soviet invasion. But they also had all these cadets that they would train, and a young Lee Harvey Oswald was in there. And the guy who founded the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol and was actually the chairman of the entire United States Civil Air Patrol in 1959 when Oswald so-called defected to the Soviet Union was a man named D. Harold Byrd. He was a magnate and very, very big in the oil industry and in mining and so forth. And D. Harold Byrd owned a building that came to be known as the Texas School Book Depository.
Oh, boy. And there are no coincidences in life here.
Well, there aren't too many coincidences in this story, and I'll tell you something. The whole backstory to Byrd, which, again, you can find in Family of Secrets, the relationship with Ruth Payne, the supposedly innocent, kindly landlady who had Lee Oswald's wife live with him while Lee went off to New Orleans and so forth. Ruth Payne, who helped Lee purportedly get his job in the Texas School Book Depository, information coming out increasingly about Ruth's family and their connections into the intelligence apparatus. Ruth's sister, who worked for the CIA in a program that was related to a precursor to the U-2 spy plane program, U-2 program with which Lee Oswald, as a Marine out of Japan, was associated with, which made him a perfect dangle to the Soviet Union. By the way, Lee Oswald was one of a number of people. Another one was named Robert Webster. These were so-called former military people who, quote-unquote, defected to the USSR in this period. And what's very, very interesting, George, is that if you look at these people, the Civil Air Patrol actually had a program early on where they were training people in Russian. They were training these young people. In other words, Lee Oswald, as a teenager, may have been encouraged to learn Russian and all this stuff long before he got his own idea, mm-hmm. supposedly, to defect to the Soviet Union. And, of course, when he supposedly defects, the U.S. government helps him. They help him every step of the way.
And they willingly bring him back.
That's right. And they send him money, and there are no repercussions of any kind. And you know what he comes back? You know what he does? Among his jobs, he works in almost every of these companies that he works in are connected to the military.
Jeez, amazing. You know, and his brother, I believe, believes that he was part of it, but I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure.
You're not so sure that Lee was an asset, you say?
Well, no, I'm not so sure that the brother really believes it. I think maybe somebody made him say it.
Yeah. I mean, it's very complicated because, you know, both of the brothers had connections into the military and various other programs themselves. There are things about the family. I think the mother, you know, that Marguerite Oswald has been vilified as this kook But if you actually read her statements carefully, she was essentially a somewhat eccentric but fairly sane woman who was struggling to get out information despite the fact that she was terrified, that there was a lot of pressure on her, and that there were things that even she couldn't talk about. And it's the same thing if you look at Jack Ruby. I mean, anybody who still believes that Jack Ruby on his own shot Oswald because he was trying to spare...
He knew Oswald, didn't he?
You know, all the evidence is that he knew Oswald. That's right. And you know, of course, Jack Ruby, after, you know, things went south and he was being hustled off, I mean, he asked the Warren Commission to put him into protective custody, to move him to Washington. He said he had some very profound things to say. You can actually watch footage of reporters yelling questions at him, and one of them says, how high up does this whole thing go, Jack? To which he replies, very high.
And then he dies of cancer in prison.
And he wasn't even ill before that, and a doctor gave him an injection.
And then the one who interviewed him, Dorothy Kilgallen, she dies.
That's right, suicide, supposedly.
Very strange. And then Marilyn Monroe dies before that.
Oh, boy. You know something? There are so many people associated with that story who died untimely deaths. There's so many of them.
Well, here's the question. Why do you think they wanted him out of the way, Kennedy? What was he doing where they needed to have him removed? Was it going after the Federal Reserve? The fact that he didn't want to commit to Vietnam, even though I'm reading a book called The Dark Days of Camelot by Seymour Hersh, and he alludes that Kennedy was responsible for, you know, the assassination of Diem, that he wasn't surprised, that he was behind it. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'll just say this. Cy Hersh and I are friends, and I respect him. I think he got that wrong. And I can almost say with certainty that Kennedy knew nothing about that. In fact,
he was in shock, I'm told.
That's right. And the same thing about, you know, you ever see that picture when he heard that the Congolese nationalist Lumumba had been assassinated?
Yes.
He's got this hand over his face and he looks in tremendous despair. The real story of John F. Kennedy, you know, I'm working on a new book and it's about Kennedy. And I'm just fascinated with what I'm learning. And one of the things I'm discovering, George, is the extent to which we have been presented a falsified history, even of who he was.
Right. Now, he was a womanizer, right? But you don't go after a president for that.
Well,
at least
you know,
not that way.
It doesn't really, that's right. I don't think that has a whole lot to do with how he was as a public figure, how he was as a leader, what kind of philosophy he brought to the job. And we get distracted by those kinds of scandals and titillating things because they're very, very easy to absorb. You know, they're not too tough on the mind. The things you and I are discussing are really much more vexing and, I think, unpleasant for a lot of people.
But I think so, too.
The truth about Kennedy is this. He really was a great reformer. If you go back to the early days of his career, he was intrigued by what you might call the third way, which was that so many of the developing countries around the world, leaders were coming to the fore who were not beholden to big countries. They were not beholden to the colonial powers. They were not beholden to the communist bloc. And he thought this was intriguing, and he was a supporter of that. And so I think from his earliest days in the U.S. Senate, if not the House of Representatives, he probably was already on the radar of a lot of these big corporations. You have to remember, or maybe not remember, but I'd say many of us never even knew the extent to which the United States supplanted great empires like Britain and France and Spain and Portugal and the Netherlands, and really after the Great Wars kind of took over this role of using these third world countries as resources to be plundered.
And we've never stopped. Russ, we're at the break, but we're going to come back and talk more about all of the things you've been working on. And we're keying in on the JFK assassination. His book is called Family of Secrets. Welcome back, Russ Baker, with us as we talk about Family of Secrets, which includes a lot of information about the JFK assassination. What's the name of the new book to be, Russ?
Not sure yet, but it's for me quite a comprehensive and exhaustive undertaking, and it is literally my attempt to connect all of the dots and see if it is possible to produce a book that kind of settles the conversation on this issue. I am trying to see if I can assemble enough of these tens of thousands of data points into a coherent, understandable, and even relatively easily digestible narrative of what actually took place all those years ago.
JFK Unwrapped. That's not a bad
one. I like that. That's not bad.
That's not bad.
Can I borrow that from you?
You can take it if you want it. Absolutely. I'll even write I'll even do a little forward for you if nobody else
That'd
done
be
it.
Great.
So let's talk a little bit about the work you did in the first book, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty. And, you know, of course, wasn't H.W. Bush, wasn't he there in Dallas on the day of the assassination?
Well, let me walk my way up to that one, if I may.
Okay.
Basically, I was researching George W. Bush and how we had gotten into Iraq and what was his, you know, how had this improbable man become president. And I've been looking at him, I began noticing that his father had intervened in many early stages of his son's life where he got in trouble, his military training and so on. I began looking at the father, trying to understand more about the father, and I started discovering that there was a lot about the father I couldn't understand, which is just how he had risen to the levels he had, because he seemed limited in many respects. And the more I looked at him, the more I discovered that there was a whole piece of his life that we didn't know about. And in a nutshell, what I found was that the father, George H.W. Bush, had been made CIA director in 1976 as a so-called outsider with no relevant experience, because he actually had relevant experience, that he himself had been a covert operative of the Central Intelligence Agency for decades of his life. Now, that's all documented in my book, Family of Secrets. And once I started documenting that, I then became interested in this story where in an interview he was asked, what do you remember when Kennedy was killed? You know, of course, that was such a major event for all of us. Where were you when you heard and so forth? And George, he just blanched. He wasn't expecting that question, and he didn't know what to say, and he claimed he couldn't remember where he was when Kennedy was shot.
And we all knew where we were at that time.
Well, that's right. I ask this question. I do a fair amount of public speaking, and I always say, how many of you, were alive at the time? And of those of you, how many of you don't remember where you were? And there's almost never anybody. So, of course, that just took me into saying, well, I'm doing research on the Bush family. I'm going to figure out where this guy was and what he was doing and why he can't remember. And this took me just into the most amazing material, including a couple of key memos showing that he was, in fact, deeply involved with the Central Intelligence Agency and with anti-Castro Cubans, and in some way was involved with briefings around the assassination. And so I said, my God, this guy is covering this thing up. I've got to figure out what this is, because he goes on to be the head of the CIA and then the president of the United States. I mean, you could never come up with a bigger story than that. And so I began looking at him, and I discovered a bunch of very, very interesting things, one of which that fascinated me was to learn that he was a lifelong friend of a man by the name of George de Morenschild.
Yes.
And you know, George, you know who he is. George de Morenschild was a Russian emigre, a very mysterious fellow who seemed to have connections into the intelligence apparatus, the top people in the oil industry and so on. And George de Morenschild also, very interestingly, was Lee Harvey Oswald's mentor. And when I found out that George H.W. Bush became president of the United States, was a lifelong friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's mentor, and that Mr. Bush couldn't remember where he was, I said, boy, I got to take a closer
look. Yeah, weird. Very strange. What did you conclude?
Well, again, this is what fills up chapters of Family of Secrets, and it's hard to hard to do a shorthand on it, but basically, I discovered that Bush was woven into this network of CIA operatives in and around Dallas at that time, and I discovered that he was hiding the fact that he was in Dallas within, let's say, hours of the shooting, that he that week had been together with a man named Alfred Ulmer, who was one of the Alan Dulles's key people, one of the CIA's leading coup d'etat plotters around the world. That Al Ulmer, who lived abroad at the time, had just by chance come to the Dallas area that week and was getting together with George H.W. Bush, who couldn't remember where he was. All of them connected again to George DeMornschild, the man who guided Lee Harvey Oswald to Ruth Payne, who got him the job in this school book depository that was owned by D. Harold Byrd, who ran the paramilitary organization that trained Lee Oswald and sent him off essentially to learn Russian and then to so-called do what I believe was a fake defection of the Soviet Union. So we begin to thread this whole thing, George. We begin to see the pieces of this. And as far as the Bushes go, basically what you're looking at is them as really not so much leaders as cogs in the enterprise of the very wealthiest Americans, American families, industrialists and financiers, and their desire to maintain their primacy. What today people like Bernie Sanders talk about, the 1% and the stranglehold over our country. And it's just fascinating. At the beginning of our conversation, George, you talked about, you know, what does the Kennedy assassination have to do with today? Mm-hmm. The answer is everything. Everything is connected, and everything that's going on today, our lack of democracy, the fact that we have very few choices in general, that the Democrats and the Republicans both seem to be the war party, all of this is connected back to the Kennedy thing. It's connected to the Bushes. It's connected to their rise. It's connected to the what seems to be a failed attempt by the family to secure a third presidency. All of these things are connected, and we hear none of it. We hear none of it in our vaunted media.
And we probably never will, Russ.
Well, that's right. And if I may just mention, that is why I started whowhatwhy.org. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative news site. You know, we don't take ads. We don't serve any particular party or interest. We just dig for the truth. And our whole aim is to sort of recreate and create anew a more honest mechanism for the public to find out what the heck is really going on, to sort of regain our control over our lives and our country. I'm very excited about it. You know, as you know, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the broadcast, I worked in major media for a lot of the big brands. And, you know, there are a lot of good things about these news organizations, but they simply cannot touch the kind of things that I think you and Coast to Coast so bravely go into. There are very, very few places that will touch any of this. And if you like, we can talk about why, but I mean, that in itself is fascinating.
Are they afraid, some of the media people? Or
they absolutely are afraid. And it's very simple why they're afraid, because all of us are you know, in this sort of corporate machine. It's a little bit like being hooked up to the Matrix. You know, our lives are determined by our willingness to go along, to conform, and to stay with the sentiment of the crowd, if you will. And the sentiment of the crowd itself is carefully shaped by these public relations and advertising entities, again, being paid by and working for these, if you want to call them sort of elites, these interests that have the money and the power and want to keep it. And so we're all told in our own ways, don't touch that sort of thing. You know, I remember in my career as a journalist, you know, the bosses at those places, they want big stories. And one of my bosses said, go out and get me a big story. And I went out, and after a few months, I came in and I brought him a story, and he read it, and he inhaled deeply, and he said, that's too big.
Huh.
And so there's this sense, George, that, you know, we want a good story, but you've got to stay with the pack. And so there's a sense, and this is why when you watch, whether it's CNN or MSNBC or whatever, you largely get kind of the same basic storyline. It's sort of crafted, and nobody dares cut completely in the opposite direction. That's why I started Who, What, Why, because we want to be free to just go wherever the story goes. And so far, for example, we've looked at some of these invasions, both the Iraq invasion under the Republicans, and then the Libya invasion, and the attempted Syria invasion under the Democrats, and we see that the stories were told, the sort of heroic positioning of the United States going into, in Afghanistan, sort of help women and human rights and so on, that there's not an ounce of truth to it. That's a story that Americans, who are good people, find satisfying, but it has nothing to do with the reasons that enterprises like the U.S. military and these giant corporations want to go in there, want to use our tax dollars, and want to sacrifice the lives of our children in these places.
Were you able to find out if we killed Osama bin Laden or whether he died from, lack of kidney dialysis?
You know, let me first of all just say for reference that anyone who wants to see what we did on this stuff, just go to whowhatwhy.org and in the search box put in these things like Osama. And George, what we did was as soon as that thing took place, I had questions. And my questions were, of course, you mentioned the stories that we had heard that Osama was ill years before, that he may have died before. I cannot say whether that was him or not, but I can tell you that that story was maximally managed, just like the Kennedy assassination Warren Commission. All of these stories are managed, and they're always managed by the same institutions, the same people, with the same game plan. The game plan is to reassure the American people that we live in a system that we can believe in, that things are stable, that the government and the military and so forth are competent and able to protect us and serve our interests. They scare us, and then they tell us that we need to turn to daddy to protect us. And in the case of Osama bin Laden, in some articles we did at Who, What, Why, we pointed out a whole bunch of anomalies. I'd love to talk about that. Maybe you and I could do a separate show on it, because there's so many pieces of that that just do not add up.
Yeah, that would be good. We should do that. And so many things are coming. Do you think Edward Snowden is a hero or a traitor?
I do think he's a hero. I think this guy took tremendous risks. Obviously, he has consecrated his life to being a whistleblower. It's very difficult to do the right thing. And we all know this. I'm sure everyone listening knows that whenever they've thought about going out on a limb, their significant other may say to them, don't do it. You're risking your livelihood, your family. Don't do it. We get told not to ruffle feathers, not to rattle things, not to put ourselves and our loved ones at risk. And, he put himself tremendously at risk. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks is another one. Obviously, Chelsea Manning is another one. These are people who said, my gosh, I believed in my country, and I found out that a lot of what I believed was a lie, and this is wrong, and it's wrong to be silent about it. We talk about the Nuremberg trials and what went wrong in Germany and how did the public go along with it. Well, we in our own country, we live with such blinders on. There are these wars going on. The United States is involved in wars in dozens of places all over the world, much of them not covered at all. And, we treat the military like it's one great, wonderful video game. It's all bound up with a sports spectatorship and the thrill of the spectacle and the chase. And it's all patches. It's a very heroic thing. But you talk to the people. I mean, today Sarah Palin's having to explain about her own son and his charges of domestic abuse against him, and that he, he went off to the wars that she supported, and he was, as she says, destroyed by them. It all comes home to roost.
Yeah, it sure does. Now, getting back to the Kennedy assassination, how do you think the Warren Commission handled things? I think poorly.
Well, it's beyond that. The first thing you have to consider about the Warren Commission is that their job, they were basically told to wrap the whole thing up and to pin it on Lee Harvey Oswald and to make it persuasive. And in my book, Family of Secrets, I have, I can't remember if it's a chapter, a big part of the chapter, about the Warren Commission, this whole process. You would think that if the Warren Commission was actually a commission of inquiry, that they would have hired investigators. And you would think that the staff would be made up of, you know, district attorneys and murder people who dealt with murders and with conspiracies and large-scale investigations. But instead, the commission itself and the staff were largely members of this same corporate establishment who hated the Kennedys. And in fact, I go through and I describe a lot of these people. And who was the vice chairman of the commission and the one who was at more of the meetings than anyone else? It was Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA who Kennedy had fired. That's the man, right? Who more than almost
they
anyone
hated
else
each other.
Had animus. That's right, had animus toward Kennedy and had every reason to want him out. Alan Dulles, the man who was in charge of the United States going around the world and removing and assassinating leaders. I mean, that in itself is staggering. And then, George, and then you look at the individual staff members in Family of Secrets. I write about a man named Albert Jenner. Albert Jenner was a staff member who was given the assignment of interviewing the most sensitive witnesses. Albert Jenner interviews George de Morenschild, and it seems that Jenner's job is to basically inoculate anyone that George de Morenschild knew and to prevent things like the fact that he was a friend of George H.W. Bush. Very weird. George de Morenschild was a friend of Jackie Kennedy's mother. I mean, this is Oswald's handler. You know, how if this any of this had come out, it would have provoked just a tremendous uproar. And so there's this Albert Jenner. What was Albert Jenner's day job, George? Albert Jenner was the lawyer for a company called General Dynamics, which was at the time one of the largest defense contractors, and it was being investigated on the day that Kennedy was assassinated. There were Senate hearings into corruption surrounding General Dynamics, Lyndon Johnson, who became president right after that, and a whole host of other people in and out of the Pentagon, banking, Texas real estate and oil. All of these people were bound up in a giant sort of infrastructure and system of corruption.
And there have been talk that LBJ was part of it.
Yes, and you know, there's a lot of debate about that. And my sense is this, and my new book on JFK is going to go much more deeply into these things. But as I point out in Family of Secrets, Johnson was a man who hated Kennedy, but not just hated him. Johnson wanted to be president and tried to run. Didn't have the personality to win in the primaries, and so Kennedy became president. Johnson hated him. They a mysterious accommodation put Johnson on the ticket. Johnson could not stomach the Kennedys. They ignored him, and he felt humiliated him. And there he was going to sit there for 8 years, biding his time until he could become president. Johnson was, and this has been documented in many, many books, I really don't know how to say it except to say that he was a criminal. He was a man who was involved in illegal and unethical things his entire life. This is documented and even in accepted.
Hold on for a sec, Russ. We're already at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and take some more phone calls with you next.